Progressive voice of Minnesota, FYI Politics with Brett Johnson on a Thursday afternoon. Busy show as usual with lots of news to get to. Also on the other side of the production glass, we got Patrick Lilia. Patrick, how are things going with you today?
Oh, good. We got more great programs recorded for the weekend. We'll talk about that later, though.
Yeah, most definitely. As usual, have a great eclectic lineup of shows here on our AM 950 weekend programming. If you only listen to the weekday programming, you're missing out. We have a lot of good weekend shows on the station, too. Let's get to the content for my show today, though. Happy to welcome in my first guest today. It is Ricardo Levins Morales. He is with the organization called MPD 150, which is working towards a police-free Minneapolis. And MPD 150 was a massive project that was put together that examines the history of the Minneapolis Police Department, talks about where we are right now, and then also where we could be going in the future in terms of law enforcement and possibly living in a police-free city. So, Ricardo, really appreciate the time today for joining me on the show.
I'm pleased to be with you.
Absolutely. So, can you tell us a little bit more about what MPD 150 is in your own words and what the, I don't know if I necessarily want to call it an organization, because it was a number of people of organizations that came together to try to put together this massive undertaking of a project. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, we started in early 2000, that the following year, 2017, would be the 150th anniversary of the founding of the department back in 1867, and it occurred to us that it might be time for a performance review. So we pulled together people from throughout the local organizing, educational, social service ecosystem, and created a task force, started doing investigations, digging into the history of the department for the 15 decades since its founding. We had an interview team that talked to frontline social service workers, people in battered women's shelters, et cetera, about their current day experience with police, and then started looking at the kinds of services and needs, the kinds of mechanisms we would need to meet the needs of the community, many needs which are now channeled through the police department, even though there's not very many of those that they actually perform well.
And how did you go about putting this together? Because I can't emphasize this enough. I've read through most of the report that you guys have over at mpd150.com. They also have an audio version of the report that I think is worth checking out. In fact, I'm probably going to be going home and listening to that as a podcast, kind of in that format. But what I want to emphasize is that this isn't just a couple of people putting together some opinion pieces. This was a huge project with lots of interviews, as you were talking about, a thorough examination of the history of the police department. So this wasn't some small endeavor. You guys put a lot of time and a lot of research into this. So how did you go about doing that?
Was that question?
Yeah, so how did you go about doing that? How did this all come together of setting up MPD 150?
Well, really, it was a question of, you know, the people who started the discussion just reaching out to folks they thought might be interested and proposing a different way of approaching the police. Because what we've seen in the process of the Black Lives Matter movement is a cycle that we've now discovered has been going back for over 100 years, but a cycle where the police will brutally kill somebody or do something that will break into the public attention as a scandal. And then you have calls for reform, and then there's a whole series, a whole toolkit of tepid reforms that get put in place. Within 3 years, they've eroded away. Another few years pass, there's another scandalous atrocity, and that cycle begins again and again. Every time there are these calls for reform, and we were thinking, well, what is it that's not working about this? What can we think about that might be a better option than calling for more civilian review boards, residency requirements, sensitivity training, and all those things that have never actually made any difference? Or, reformist police chiefs, who really don't, when we look at the structure of policing, chiefs and mayors and municipal governments actually have very little power over departments. So we wanted to break it down so that we could talk about the alternatives. And our conclusion is that, in fact, the police department, given their DNA, given their origins in the slave patrols and the factory watch system, et cetera, that they really are resistant to change because their very nature is to be policing racial boundaries. You know, and when we talk about police atrocities, that's not counting the day-to-day endless harassment that people in dark communities experience. You know, the fundamental function, and we go into in depth in all these areas in, at the150.com, but the fundamental function following the Civil War was to channel newly emancipated black people through the criminal justice system, which was expanding at that time, give them criminal records that would exclude them from access to credit, jobs, education, voting, land, etc., so that these would be preserved as a special privilege for white people. And that also explains why it's so easy to grow up white in this country and not actually, and be rather naive, not really know what the police function is, because the idea is that, you know, white people are treated nicely. And so their assumption is that if the, you know, dark black folks, indigenous folks, Latinos are having a hard time with the police, they must be committing crimes, they must be doing something wrong, they must not be following instructions, they're bad in some way. Because, look, you know, they've always been nice to me.
Let's talk about the history and the legacy of the Minneapolis Police Department, and especially in its early years, because this is something that's often forgotten. And as I was reading through, it's just crazy to read through some of the corruption and some of the actions that the force was taking back in the late 19th century and even into the early 20th century. We have examples of how, well, the force was essentially used as just an arm to break up union strikes, especially in the early years. We had cases where basically a new mayor would come in, fire the entire police department, bring in their own force, and then selectively enforce laws. We have, of course, examples of Doc Ames, who, by the way, if you don't know who Doc Ames is, I encourage you to read up on him, might be the most corrupt politician in Minnesota history, using the police as his own kind of personal force for making his life more profitable. So there's certainly a history there, especially in the early years of the police department, really acting as a vehicle for people who are in an economic power of strength of really making sure that they stay and keep their power.
Yeah, they really functioned as a arm, in a sense, of the Citizens Alliance, which was a right-wing business association that used them against labor. And this is something, the trajectory of policing across the country follows certain distinct stages, so that there was a period when police departments were essentially the enforcement arm of big patronage political machines, you know, collecting the bribes and so forth. When I first came to the U.S. from Puerto Rico, where I was born, in the 1960s, that was under the Mayor Daley's machine, and that was in the era of kind of the end of the big political machines. As those disintegrated under various kind of reform efforts, police departments emerged as the most powerful element of municipal governments. So that you have a situation like, you know, just in the last few weeks, city council members here like Fletcher and Cunningham have been talking about how when they've made moves that the police department doesn't like, the call response time in their ward starts slowing down. When people ask the police, why is it taking you so long? The response is, ask your council member. So you have these ways in which the police department protect their own political interests. And of course now, increasingly in the last 10 years, and this has been accelerating, the police are really integrated more into the Homeland Security apparatus, fusion centers, a police supply industry that's very strong, so that in fact they get their marching orders, their culture, a lot of their intelligence, bypassing the municipal governments that supposedly are controlling them. So that a mayor can elect a chief, but a chief only serves at the pleasure of the rank and file. And if they don't like what the chief is doing, it really makes no difference what their intentions are, how reformist-minded, what color their skin, the underlying iceberg underneath the tip of administration changes very little in its essential nature. It's changing some of the functioning. So, for example, at periods like the 60s, and there's been certain periods when they needed to improve their image and so have absorbed social service functions so that communities now think, well, you know, what do I do if my little girl is missing? Who can I turn to? Because those resources have been monopolized. Whereas if the resources that are being squandered on this very violent paramilitary militia and on the, even just on the brutality court settlements that the cities always have to pay out, if those were put into the things that it's, you know, communities actually needed, that would actually take care of a lot of the causes for property theft. If you look at white suburbs, for example, where they're not over-policed, there are not a lot of outbursts of crime, of protest, you know, mental illness is not treated violently. Why? Because people there have decent housing. They have good jobs. They have clean water. They have parks to play in, right? So that's really the fundamental first step is, of course, if you get people what they need and allow them to have access to what they need, then they won't be going out in various dysfunctional ways to try to get those needs met.
I think there's a disconnect that you were kind of hitting on, too, where people who might be living in the suburbs or people who might be white thinking, well, I've never had a negative interaction with the police before. And I think people do recognize that in the past, you know, you date back to pre-World War II or you look at the Depression era. Yeah, people recognize that the police was a brutal force back then. But there's a disconnect where people sometimes think, well, now the police are good. But I don't know, if you kind of look at like the essence of what law enforcement essentially is to solve disputes between people. And generally, law enforcement is going to side with the people who are from a better economic position. I mean, maybe another way to even thinking about it is if you're someone who doesn't usually have negative interactions with the police, think about what happened with, let's say, like the Wall Street crash of 2008 and how no bankers went to jail because the law enforcement system we had in place said, well, we're not going to jail any bankers. So I think there's a disconnect there because that same type of law enforcement does trickle down to that local level where, for the most part, police slash law enforcement are going to side with people who are more economically well off.
And it's something that goes way back also. Frederick Douglass, who I think of as the most influential blogger of the 19th century, talked about how what might happen after emancipation. This was during the Civil War. And he said that the worst thing that could happen is that blacks be subjugated as collectively instead of owned by individual owners, and that white people, if they did something bad, would be treated as individual offenders, whereas black people would be treated as collectively guilty. And, you know, white, black people who did anything special or achieved something good would be seen as the exception to the rule rather than a representative of, you know, creative, beautiful, capable people like anybody else. Now, and here's another thing, is that I've come to the point where I will no longer refer to the police as law enforcement. You know, much of what they do is actually illegal. And even when they're enforcing laws, so a lot of what they do is traffic stops, marijuana busts, a lot of low-level offenses, and they approach all of these through a lens of racial profiling. So that means that then they're enforcing these regulations on a particular population many times with much more force than on, you know, the population whose support they want. So that means that essentially, even though technically it's legal to stop somebody for running a red light, it's actually committing a crime to do so on the basis of race. So that when we look at how much of what they do, if anyone has had a confrontation or argument with a cop on the street, you'll know that they actually don't know very much about the law. They say, no, you listen to me, you do what I say, I am the law, and don't get sassy with me, and okay, that's enough, you know, hands in cuffs, get in the car. But as far as them actually knowing, you know, what they're mandated to do in the law books, I haven't experienced that they have much of an idea of that.
So when people hear about this happening, they think, well, we can just reform the police department and then problems will be solved. But it's shocking to go through and read the report and talk about some of the reforms that we've tried in the past with the Minneapolis Police Department, and they mirror exactly like some of the proposals we're talking about today. One that really struck out to me was, I think this was back in the 1970s, how there was this idea that, well, if we make the police more visible and have them interact with citizens, it will improve relations and therefore reduce crime and reduce negative interactions with the police. And lo and behold, it didn't do a whole lot. And there's just so many of these ideas that seem like they're being recycled year after year after year when it comes to police reform.
Yeah, what you're describing is really an early version of what is today called community policing.
Mm-hmm.
And community policing in the 1970s, after the police had really damaged their public legitimacy through the brutality with which they suppressed the political movements of the 60s, they were successful in suppressing the Black Panther Party and many other organizations, but at a great cost to public perception. So community policing is a concept borrowed from counterinsurgency theory in the military. That is, how do you win hearts and minds while carrying out whatever you need to carry out, right? So that community policing really has had two elements. One is cops in shorts on bicycles and handing out ice cream cones in the park, and making little basketball leagues with high school kids. And it's also been accompanied by more investment into SWAT teams and relying on tips instead of real investigations. You have these paramilitary raids that often break into the wrong apartments with tragic results. So there's always been this kind of velvet glove and iron fist that doesn't actually reduce police violence, but it creates relationships in the community so that when the police do kill somebody, an unarmed black kid or whatever, they have people who they've built relationships with who can help smooth things over, calm down the community, tell everybody, well, all cops aren't bad, it's a bedworthy issue, mm-hmm. and they're not facing the same degree of protest and opposition. And again, speaking of MPD150.com, the website, within a few weeks, we'll be created by multiple artists.
Oh, Ricardo, just got to interrupt you. You just cut out, I think, on the phone just as you were saying that. Can you back up just a couple sentences ago?
Sure. So MPD150 or MPD150.com, if you want to look it up, within a few weeks, we'll be releasing a comic book created by multiple artists in the community that specifically explains the realities behind what's called community policing. Because in moments like this, you have everybody saying, oh my gosh, this has been terrible. What we really need to do is institute community policing, build trust with the community, those kinds of things. And that really is just kind of a Trojan horse. Nothing really changes with what community policing any more than the other reforms. And we're putting out this comic book to be able to really explain how that works, right? So we need to go beyond. So when we started doing this work, part of the problem is that to mention the idea of a future without police or police abolition would be seen as this utopian fantasy, like, oh my God, what Kool-Aid have you been drinking? But I think that what we've done through our work and along with other organizations in the Twin Cities is be able to demonstrate that actually the idea that policing, which has for 15 decades never varied from its original funding mission, that's going to become something different, that's really magical thinking. We need to close the door on that, and then we start looking at, well, what do police do? And I wonder how many of your listeners can name something that police departments actually do well. They don't solve that many murders. They certainly don't respond to sexual assault. They're not the ones who pass out of trees, that's the department. So other than sort of the racial enforcement, mass incarceration pipeline, there's not a lot that they actually do well. So that we have people who are competent and deal with situations of mental health crisis, for example, in an adult way, and have know how to deal with violent people without shooting them. But, pointing a gun and screaming at somebody who's having a mental health crisis is not really good therapy. And often what the police will say is, well, the person wasn't following our instructions. Hello. What part of mental health crisis don't you understand? So So really when we look at, you know, so the strategy that groups like Reclaim the Block, Black Visions Collective, who we work closely with, have been pursuing is to begin taking chunks of that police budget and some of the functions and just starting to shift them into community locations where people who are really, whose training is to help people, not paramilitary training, and to start shifting those budgets and those services to where they'll do the most good. And if you meet people's needs, they have the housing, they have the food, they have decent jobs, well, that takes care of most property crime and a lot of the mental stress that causes emotional crisis. And then, of course, you're still going to need people trained to deal with those much-reduced exceptions where somebody is totally off the wall, completely hostile, traumatized to a degree that you can't reason with them. And that will require, to be realistic, some capacity to use the tools of physical restraint, coercion, and violence if necessary. But that is calibrated to the actual situation and not kind of the default of a cop who looks at somebody, sees their skin is dark, sees that they're holding something in their hand and opens fire.
And what you're talking about, too, as I'm hearing you talk about this idea that, well, for the most part, police exist to lock people up when they commit a crime. And I think what you're talking about when we go with this idea of abolishing or defunding the police, what it really means is allocating those resources towards preventing crime in the first place, where law enforcement and police, it looks at just dealing with the symptom and not the cause as to why people are committing crimes.
Well, of course. And what happens is that people who are marginalized, sidelined, whose needs aren't being met by the system, are considered to be criminal by their existence. So homelessness is considered to be an infraction. Drug addiction, vacate for unhappiness, is seen to be an infraction. And even immigration, where our policies have devastated other communities, other countries' economies for our own benefit, people simply moving toward where there's more resource or possible employment are also considered as criminal. So that you have the police apparatus, including ICE, including, you know, military, including the police departments and sheriff's departments, being in place to punish people for being hurt by the system that excludes them.
We've been speaking with Ricardo Levins-Morales. He is with MPD 150. That website is mpd150.com. I wish we had more time because we've only scratched the surface of what you can find over at mpd150.com. I really recommend you go and check that out. There's lots of great pages you can find on there in terms of finding alternatives when you run into a situation where you might call the police. There are some alternatives that you can use. They also have examples of the success and failure of police reform that we've seen in the past. And, of course, they also have an audio version of this as well. So a lot of great information there. Highly recommended, mpd150.com. Ricardo, I really appreciate the time today.
Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, definitely. Wish we had more time, but the clock dictates that we are, unfortunately, out of time. But I again, highly recommend that, mpd150.com. I was on there today. I could spend hours on that thing. But there are so many great resources right there, especially if you're someone who's very hesitant about, well, should we, what does this mean when people say we're going to defund or abolish the police? Check that out, mpd150.com, talking about the history of it and then what alternatives could look like as to alternatives to the police system that we have right now in Minneapolis and the entire state of Minnesota. We're going to take a break on FYI Politics with Brett Johnson. We'll be back in just a few minutes.
With all the convenient big box stores that sell appliances, why do so many Minnesotans choose Warner Stellion? Check online to learn that Warner Stellion is a Minnesota family-owned business for over 60 years. Warner Stellion sells more brands than anyone else, and our passionate specialists are committed to impressing you so much that you'll refer us to everyone you know. That's our mission here at Warner Stellion. Ask around. Check us out online. And when it's your time to buy appliances, join over 300,000 Minnesota homeowners and choose the specialists, Warner Stellion.
Seward Co-op, serving the community for nearly 45 years, invites you to shop their two convenient locations, both offering the strong commitment to local producers and healthy foods you've come to expect. Seward focuses on locally grown and raised products, fair trade, and environmental sustainability. Shop their selection of meats, artisan cheeses, and house-made baked goods. Find Seward at 2823 East Franklin Avenue or the Friendship Store on 38th Street and 3rd Avenue in Minneapolis. More at seward.coop.
Howdy, Matt McNeil here, and I love Rudy Luther, and not just because of my love of the Toyota Sienna. I keep going back because of Luther's top-notch customer service. A great example of that is the Luther Advantage Card. With every new and used vehicle purchase, you'll get 3 years of 10 cents off per gallon of gas at Holiday Station stores and $5 off the Works car washes. The Luther Advantage Card keeps you happy in your Rudy Luther vehicle, which in turn makes me and many others very loyal Rudy Luther customers. Find out more at Rudy Luther Toyota, 394 and 169 in Golden Valley.
Hi, this is Laura. These are indeed confusing times. So much of our life, education, business, meetings have moved online, yet not everyone has internet access. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota, is here for everyone. Radio reaches people without internet. In fact, radio reaches more Americans than any other platform. 92% of U.S. adults listen to radio every week. Radio connects. If you know some organization, maybe a religious or civic group, seeking to engage and knows that a Zoom call costs money and does not reach everyone, consider a taped or live broadcast on AM 950. Perhaps a virtual not-so-silent auction, recovery support, spiritual support, business networking, poetry slam. If you want to learn more about creating a live or taped message on AM 950, call 952-946-8885 or email Laura at am950radio.com. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota, here for everyone.
Hi, everyone. Matt McNeil here. You might recognize my son, Charlie.
Hi, everyone.
Coronavirus has impacted us in many ways, but we at AM 950 wanted to take time to recognize a group of people who are experiencing this crisis in a very different way, high school and college graduates.
I'm a member of the Hopkins High School class of 2020. Many in my grade were looking forward to ending out our senior year with a graduation ceremony. Unfortunately, all of the traditional events won't take place for my class.
Funny, they managed to get all the testing and finals in.
Yeah, all the fun stuff. Anyway, we understand no one can plan for a pandemic, and you have to make sacrifices for the common good. Considering many people are having a much harder time, the class of 2020 will manage. We'll miss the graduation experience, but we'll share this time as we head into the next chapter of our lives. Oh, and by the way, go Gophers.
On behalf of everyone at AM 950, a big salute to all the graduates for 2020. We know this isn't how you envision this happening, but just because there's no grand ceremony doesn't mean we're not proud. You've accomplished so much. All our best as you take the next steps in your journey. Congratulations from AM 950.
During this stay-at-home time, many of us are getting around to what needs doing at home. So how is your vacuum cleaner running? Is it time to get it repaired or maybe even replaced? Great news! A1 Vacuum in Roseville is open for curbside service. We're here from 10 until 2, Monday through Saturday. Give us a call at 651-222-6316 to place your order for curbside supplies, repairs, or replacements. Find more information and updates at a-1vacuum.com.
With your AM 950 weather, I'm Brett Johnson. Look for sunny skies today with a high near 78. Tonight, clear with a low around 56. Friday, sunny with a high near 75. And Saturday, partly cloudy with a high around 73. And with bars and restaurants set to reopen for both indoor and outdoor seating, make sure you consider our Eat Local Minnesota restaurants for the next time you go out. All of those restaurants are locally owned and operated, and they have a wide variety of food and drinks you can choose from. Find a full list of all of those restaurants at eatlocalminnesota.com. And by the way, one of those restaurants that is now open to more dining is Crooner's Supper Club, located off Moore Lake and Highway 65. They have two great venues where you can still see some live music from a safe distance. They have kind of like a drive-in theater type of thing where you can sit in your car and then listen to some great live performances. Then they've also opened up kind of this patio and deck area where you can take in some live performances and eat some delicious food, all while maintaining that proper physical distance. So check that out. That is one of the restaurants that, of course, is part of our Eat Local Minnesota lineup. Find the entire lineup over at eatlocalminnesota.com. That is eatlocalminnesota.com. So just revisiting what we were talking about with Ricardo of MPD150.com, he was bringing up, I think, a really profound point, and it's something that even
kind of jogged my memory. How often when you call the police to report a crime, does that crime actually get solved? Like, I can think back to a few years ago, for instance, when I had a radio from my car stolen. A 1991 Maxima, of all things. Who steals a radio from a 1991 Maxima? So this was a number of years ago, and I didn't even call the police because I knew that crime obviously wasn't going to be solved. But even if you talk about more serious issues like he was mentioning with sexual assault, look at the number of times rape and sexual assault cases go unsolved. So I think that's a fair point he brings up, that oftentimes when you talk about crimes and you report them to the police, well, how often do they even get solved? And bringing up too how, for the most part, yeah, some of their time is spent doing traffic stops. And if you are a white person, you generally aren't going to get pulled over by the police. One of the things that really highlighted the privilege I think I have as a white guy was a few years ago when I moved to a different state, I had to, of course, get different license tabs. And I had registered to get those different license tabs, but it was just a mess to actually get the physical tabs on my license plate. As I knocked down the Lysol bottle next to me here, I had trouble getting the actual tabs that I could put on my plate, so I was driving with expired tabs. This went on for several months, and you want to know how many times I was pulled over? Zero. I was never pulled over once, and I have to imagine if I was a person of color, yeah, you would probably be getting pulled over at a pretty high frequency if you had license tabs that were out of date. So, encourage you to check out that website, mpd150.com, mpd150.com, and I love that they have their report in an audio/podcast format. That is something I am definitely going to be checking out. I only had just enough time to kind of skim through their entire website, but even the resources I saw were definitely worth checking out, especially if you're unfamiliar with what defunding or abolishing the police looks like, because it's not just having lawlessness and no societal structure with where you live. It's really moving those resources towards preventing crime and not just dealing with the symptom. It's dealing with the cause of why the crime is actually happening. We're at 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. We do have open phone lines for the rest of the hour. So in a letter obtained by the Star Tribune from several members of the Minneapolis Police Department, they wrote a letter called "Dear Everyone, but especially Minneapolis citizens." And they claim to represent a vast majority of the Minneapolis officers and how they feel at this point. And in this letter, they write that, quote, "We want to work with you and for you to regain your trust." They also talk about how they wholeheartedly condemn fired Officer Derek Chauvin, who, of course, is jailed and awaiting trial on second-degree murder charges of George Floyd. They go on to say, "Like us, Derek Chauvin took an oath to hold the sanctity of life most precious. Derek Chauvin failed as a human and stripped George Floyd of his dignity and his life. That is not who we are," unquote. And they say that they are ready to listen and embrace calls for change, reform, and rebuilding. They go on to say, quote, that "we are leaders, formal and informal, and from all ranks within the department. We're not the union or the administration. We are officers who represent the voices of hundreds of other Minneapolis police officers," hundreds, period. "We acknowledge that Chief Arredondo needs each of us to dutifully follow him while he knows that change is going to be on the way." So, yeah, it's a nice gesture, I guess, put out by members of the police department. And they say they represent the vast majority of how police officers feel. But the question I still go back to is, if these represent the majority of how officers feel, how many of them voted for someone like Bob Kroll when it came to choosing their union head? Remember, Bob Kroll, when he was reelected as the union head, got 70% of the vote. 7-0. So chances are some who signed this letter probably voted for someone like Bob Kroll. So, yeah, while this is a nice gesture, I also question, well, how many of these types of officers are making sure that their fellow colleagues are not engaging in actions that hurt other members of the community? How many of them are willing to break that so-called thin blue line? So, yeah, I get the gesture right here, and I think this is probably them kind of seeing that we're in a whole lot of trouble here, being that there is a big movement to completely change or defund or eliminate the police department. A nice gesture, but this might be too little too late, and I still bring up that very profound point that, well, if you all feel this way and feel like Derek Chauvin, yeah, doesn't represent the rest of the department, still, a lot of you voted for someone like Bob Kroll who enabled officers like Derek Chauvin. And I certainly hope anyone who signed this letter is very willing to try to call out or prevent colleagues in engaging in actions that do hurt other members of the community that they might be interacting with as police officers. Hey, we got a couple of phone lines that have been lighting up. Let's go to Steve in Minneapolis first. Hi there, Steve. What are you thinking about today?
Hey, well, this is just a couple of things, Brent, and nice to chat with you. Last time I saw you was at the Blue State Ball where I performed with my group.
Oh, that's right, yes.
It's nice to hear you. So there are three brief things. One is that, you know, I agree, it's a very nice gesture, but that being the case, then what action is being taken within the union to get rid of this, of their president?
Mm-hmm.
And do they have any, what are their rules of order that allow them to, you know, remove him, impeach him, get him to resign, that type of thing?
Mm-hmm.
Point number, the other thing is that I have to tell you that this has nothing to do, this is a little bit far afield, but the Men in Blue have saved when my wife was alive, they saved her life multiple times by being first responders. And oftentimes they are first responders.
Mm-hmm.
They were able to administer a life-saving stopgap treatment until the paramedics could arrive. My third point is that I think that in terms of change, I think one of the things that would really be important is that we should make it a requirement of all police officers to carry personal liability insurance, just like doctors.
Mm-hmm.
I think they would think twice before doing some random act of cruelty. Those that have that propensity and those that are of that ilk, if you will find it more and more difficult to find work because they just won't be able to be insured.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so for instance, if they commit a number of actions that leads to them being disciplined, yeah, their insurance premiums would be so high they could not afford to be a police officer anymore.
Or they would be completely uninsurable, and they mm-hmm. wouldn't be able to go out of state and work for some other, you know, out of state and be hired by some state that's a little bit more friendly to their way of thinking, although those are in air quotes.
Mm-hmm.
They just wouldn't be able to get a job because they would be uninsurable.
Mm-hmm. Well, appreciate the phone call. Oh, yeah. Go ahead, Steve.
One last thing is that since they had personal liability insurance, then lawsuits to the city would not be paid for by you and me.
Yeah, and that's a key thing that you would need with that type of system where you, yeah, would have officers that would be personally liable if they end up committing actions that, well, would cause them to pay civil damages. That is part of the battle right there because they do have that qualified immunity where, for the most part, they are protected from, well, having to pay any penalties that they might incur. So that's certainly a problem right there. And then you have the entire judicial system that you would have to deal with as well because you would need a judicial system to find an officer guilty, not just on a criminal charge, but also on the civil charges, too. So, yeah, it's a couple of big steps right there, but certainly something that I think should be on the table.
I agree. Thank you for taking the call.
Hey, good to talk to you again, Steve, and great music at the Blue State Ball. Again, he was our musician if you were over there at our Blue State Ball back in February. That was only like 2 weeks before the world pretty much changed here in Minnesota. I think that was one of the last weekends where you could go to a large venue with no restrictions. Let's talk to Gary in Minneapolis who has some thought on policing. Hey, Gary. How are you doing today?
I agree with that liability insurance. I mentioned the other day. But the blacks are sure hard to kill accountable to themselves, you know, the way the system is. But they love to arrest. They focus mostly on black people because whites smoke pot just as much as black people. The whites are, they got more prestige or something, white privilege. So that gives an arrest record, and it's hard to get work. It's hard just to get anything, apartment or anything, I think. And then, there's an old story, the police are the white man's friend, but not so much of a friend of the black man.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's those old saying, treat somebody like a dog, expect to get bitten. We're seeing it now.
All right. Appreciate the phone call there, Gary. Always good to hear from our friend Gary in Minneapolis, who we also saw back at the Blue State Ball in February. But this whole idea of how law enforcement and the police works, I think it does break down to the fact that the police function to resolve disputes between two people. That's essentially how the police have always functioned. And if you think about it in a really simplistic sense, again, this is completely oversimplifying the issue. Usually law enforcement, and that doesn't just include police, that can include other agencies, whether the FBI or even the judicial system, they're generally going to side with those who have a better economic standing. That's how our entire system of politics has worked, not just in this country, but really the entire world. So the problem even goes deeper than that. We're at 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. We're going to take one final break and come back with a few more quick hitter stories. Still lots more news to get to here on FYI Politics with Brett Johnson.
Seward Co-op, serving the community for nearly 45 years, invites you to shop their two convenient locations, both offering the strong commitment to local producers and healthy foods you've come to expect. Seward focuses on locally grown and raised products, fair trade, and environmental sustainability. Shop their selection of meats, artisan cheeses, and house-made baked goods. Find Seward at 2823 East Franklin Avenue or the Friendship Store on 38th Street and 3rd Avenue in Minneapolis. More at seward.coop.
Native Roots Radio presents I'm Awake would like to say Pinigigi for all your support these last 3 years. We discuss national and local Native news and events. Weekly correspondents bring us updates and information from all over Turtle Island.
Native Roots Radio I'm Awake is supported by Robbins Kaplan, LLP, dedicated to redefining high-stakes litigation representation in Indian country.
Saturdays live 1 to 3. Free Leonard Peltier.
Is your remote workforce putting your company at risk? Cyber criminals are targeting your employees with COVID-19-inspired emails and attacking businesses like yours. Hi, Mark Sommerfeld from Rymark. Rymark has the tools and expertise to enable your employees to work securely from home. If you need help getting your staff to work remotely and securely, call 651-328-8900 or go to RymarkIT.com. That's 651-328-8900 or RymarkIT.com.
I'm Candy Broffel, publisher of the Twin Cities edition of Natural Awakenings magazine and host of Green Tea Conversations, a new show for people who are on a journey to take responsibility for their health and play a more active role in their family's well-being. Join me every Sunday at 10 a.m. as I interview local experts who share the latest in natural holistic approaches in a fun and informative way. So grab a cup of tea and join the conversation as we awaken to natural health. Visit us at naturaltwincities.com.
At Advance Auto Parts, we want to make sure your vehicle is ready to roll when you are. So when it's time to get back on the road, we offer free battery testing and installation with batteries starting at just $79.99. And right now, you can do your part to help a community hero stay on the road. Visit AdvanceAutoParts.com to nominate someone who deserves our support, and you could each win $1,000. Advance your auto at Advance Auto Parts and participating CarQuest locations.
Hi, everybody. This is Paul Metzen inviting you to listen to a great new episode on the Wall of Power Radio Hour this weekend. My guest for the whole show, Mr. Aaron Dixon. He wrote a book called My People Are Rising, a memoir of a Black Panther Party captain. Speaking from his home in New Mexico, tells me about his political awakening, listening to Martin Luther King speak as a young child, and his time in the Black Panthers, and more. This Saturday on AM 950 at 6 p.m., the progressive voice of Minnesota.
Back on the final segment of FYI Politics with Brett Johnson. Let's go to some national stories. These are courtesy of Sam Cedar over at AM Quickie. Louisville, Kentucky police have finally released an autopsy report for Breonna Taylor. That's a story that at least has been kind of lost in the media amid all that's been happening. If you don't remember the Breonna Taylor story, she was sleeping in her home with her boyfriend. the police came to their home mistakenly, unannounced, with guns drawn, and then Breonna Taylor ended up getting shot because her boyfriend, thinking that there was a home intruder because, again, the police didn't even announce their presence, he ended up pulling out a gun. He was shot. She was shot and killed as well, just to refresh your memory on that. Yeah, she was shot in her home 3 months ago. The four-page report on the autopsy was mostly blank. It said she sustained no injuries, though she was shot at least 8 times. All three officers remain on the job. Absolutely unbelievable. Yeah, don't forget about Breonna Taylor. In San Francisco, police told the transit agency there to, quote, lose their phone number after the agency said it would no longer ferry cops to protests. That's similar to what we've kind of seen in Minnesota, according to one of our city councilors, Steve Fletcher, who was talking about how when he was even just proposing a slight cut to the police budget, they immediately decided, well, we're going to reduce our response time in your district. And in fact, when residents ended up complaining about the reduced response time, the dispatchers were told to say that, well, ask your city councilor. So, yeah, there's an example there. In New York, conditions in jails where protesters have been sent are reportedly abysmal, with people being denied water and masks to protect themselves from the coronavirus. That despite the fact that many of these protesters probably won't even face or be convicted of any criminal charges, they're still being denied, yeah, those very basic needs. And in Arizona, migrants in federal custody were ordered to clean private prisons where COVID-19 has spread out of control. Inmates are reportedly pleading for protective gear and fear for their lives. That's another case where you're talking about migrants who have not committed or been convicted of any crimes. Yeah, they're being forced to clean these private prisons facilities where COVID-19 has been spreading. That is... That's another thing that's been really lost among our whole news cycle is just the treatment of migrants that we've been hearing about over the past few months. A few days ago, I know I was talking about that story, how there's been these disinfectants that have been sprayed in these detention facilities that apparently, when exposed to skin, can cause you to bleed. Or there's been reports of migrants who have been sneezing blood because these federal agencies are repeatedly spraying these detention facilities like 50 times a day. In fact, even the manufacturer of that disinfectant is saying that, yeah, you're spraying it way too often. So, yeah, another thing that sometimes gets lost in the news, and that is really disturbing going back to this Arizona story about how, yeah, basically these immigrants are being forced to clean COVID-19 infected private prisons, keeping in mind one more time that these immigrants have not been convicted of any crime whatsoever. Then I mentioned yesterday how Donald Trump is going to be resuming his big MAGA rallies. And as I looked at the timing of this and did a little more research on this and saw some people tweeting about this, the timing is really suspicious, the time and the place as to where Trump is going to be holding his first MAGA restarting rally. So it's going to be next Friday in Tulsa, Oklahoma. That would be Friday 19th in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And that's significant for a couple of reasons, whether intentional or not, by the Trump campaign. So 99 years ago in the month of June, Tulsa was the site of race riots. And not by black people, race riots by white people. If you research the history of the Tulsa race riots, what happened was that there were a number of white people who ended up going into a predominantly and very economically well-off black community and basically burning buildings and also killing a number of black people who lived in that area. That was 99 years ago taking place in the month of June. And then June 19th also happens to be Juneteenth, which is the annual holiday commemorating black emancipation. So I do find that time and location very odd that the restarting of the Trump MAGA rallies are going to be on June 19th, the same day as Juneteenth, and it's going to be taking place in the city and in the same month where the Tulsa race riots took place. I'm not sure if that was intentionally done, but either way, that is really, really bad optics. So I found that, just a few people reporting on that, it was something that kind of eclipsed my mind. I was just more looking at the fact that, oh, yeah, Trump's starting his MAGA rallies again. But, yeah, the time and location are certainly very curious in that case. Also in the news today, what happened yesterday in Minnesota, you probably saw that the Christopher Columbus statue got taken down. Several other Confederate statues and Christopher Columbus statues also were taken down. We had the Jefferson Davis statue that was taken down in Virginia. This was a theme we saw all over the country, including here in Minnesota, where the Columbus statue went down. Now, what I find interesting about this is that so often I hear people saying, well, by taking down the Columbus statue or taking down these Columbus monument or these Confederate monuments, you're erasing history, which is not at all the purpose of that whatsoever. Matt, I thought, brought up a good point on this yesterday. Who learns their history through statues and monuments? You learn your history mostly through history books or through people who teach history. Nobody goes and looks at a statue and says, oh, well, that's how I learned that Jefferson Davis led the Confederacy. That's not at all how people learn about history. Or the example we talked about how yesterday. How do people still know about Albert Einstein, even though we don't have any statues of Albert Einstein or any streets or any lakes that were named after him? So that kind of gets lost sometimes when people talk about how, well, by tearing down these statues, we are erasing history. That's not the case whatsoever. People aren't all of a sudden going to forget Christopher Columbus or forget the atrocities of what happened with the Confederate States just because we're taking down a statue. I've never quite gotten that logic as to why we need statues to learn about history. A few more stories to point out before we have to wrap things up today. This is on the national side of things, on the national level with the Supreme Court. There have been a number of progressive advocacy organizations that have aligned themselves together and are encouraging any potential new Democratic president to pack the courts with progressive justices. Take Back the Court, as well as the Progressive Change Institute, Be a Hero, 350, also Friends of the Earth and others have signed an open letter that are urging Democratic candidates, and I think most notably Joe Biden, of course, to make sure that they do pack the courts should he be elected, because their logic is that, well, Republicans have been technically packing the courts for years and years, when they point out that Barack Obama, back when he was president, was denied a number of court appointees. Now, Joe Biden says he does not support packing the courts, as at a debate last year he said he would not get into court packing. We had three justices. Next time around we lose control, they'll add three justices in regards to the Republicans. That's who he's referring to. And he says we begin to lose any credibility that the court has whatsoever. I don't know. I would at least point out with that Republicans will still probably try to block his judicial nominees, especially if there is a Republican Senate, and they're not going to care what is or is not appointed by a Democratic president. They're still going to go on and continue to pack the courts. So that's kind of an issue I feel strongly about, where somehow you need to reform the way that judges are appointed. One of the ideas I have is that I think you should have all federal judges and even state judges serve a fixed one term. Obviously, we don't want them facing election, but give them one 10-year term or one 15-year term so you can at least make it predictable when you will have judicial vacancies. All right, that's all the time I got for my show today. Stay tuned. We got Matt McNeil coming up next here on AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota.